Welcome to another edition of Simons Says, a podcast devoted to conversationalists and the curious minded. Here's your host, me, the follically challenged Dave Simons, certified financial planner and all-around nice guy. All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Simons Says podcast. We are going to have some fun. I mean, we're going to rock and roll, and the time is going to go by very quickly because of my guest. And we have some stories to tell. And yeah, we're going to name drop. I mean, we can't help it. Between my guest and myself, we are going to throw out probably some well-known names in the field of sports, entertainment, news, because my guest has kind of been around the block in some major metro areas. He's met a lot of people, and we're going to have some fun talking about that. But I have to tell you something. The first time I ever heard this man's name, I didn't meet him. I heard him in a different venue. And it was probably about 6 or 7 years before I actually got to meet him. And to be honest, the first time I heard the name, it was not said in the kindest way possible. Let me explain. So this is early 80s, January of 1983. And I walk into my broadcast journalism class at Mizzou. And this is one of my broadcast journalism professors. And by the way, this guy, I loved him. He was a happy-go-lucky guy, and he was so supportive of all the broadcast journalism students going through there, and he was well-known. But this particular morning, he was glum. You could just tell something was wrong. Like, did something happen with his family or what have you? So we all sat down. There's a small class, maybe 20 to 25 people. And he proceeds to tell us, "Ladies and gentlemen, the industry that you're about to go in is changing before your eyes, and I don't mean that in a good way necessarily. And to prove that, I want all of you to watch part of a sportscast embedded within a newscast of a station in Boston that just happened." And he puts in the old VHS tape, and we see this sports guy. Of course, it starts with the news people, and you know how that is. Everyone's on set, and you've got the two anchors typically, and they're pitching it to the sports guy, and they got a little banter. And this was right after the Super Bowl that had just been played in 1983 between the upstart Miami Dolphins and Dan Marino, and they were taking on the very well-known and established Washington Redskins and Joe Theismann and John Riggins. And this sportscaster had predicted that the Dolphins would win. And any of you sports fans out there, especially football fans, know that did not occur. The Redskins won the Super Bowl, and they won going away. So the sportscaster admitted he messed up. He got it wrong. And he said, as the camera turned tight on him, he said, "And boy, do I have egg on my face." He then took an egg. And by the way, nobody knew this was coming. His co-anchors over to his right didn't know this. He took an egg and live on TV smashed it against his head. And you could hear the gasp of one of his co-anchors to his right. And I heard the gasp in my broadcast journalism class. We're like, what the heck is going on? And he proceeds to do the rest of his sportscast with egg and yolk coming down his face. Little did he, could he have known at the time, the you-know-what storm that he just created, not only in Boston because it became a hot topic, but within a day or two, we're talking about it in Columbia, Missouri. And to this day, that story still kind of follows him around because of people like me who like to talk about it. Also, little did I know at the time, as I'm watching that videotape in late January of 1983, that just about 7 years later, I would be working for him and working with him. And not only would he become a colleague of mine, but he would also become one of my very good friends, even to this day, believe it or not, 40 years after I first heard that name. And with that as an introduction, I bring to you my special guest on Simon Says today, Zip Rezepa. Zip, how are you doing?
Dave, I'm doing great. That was one sensational introduction.
Well, you know, there's so much to talk about. Obviously, when you started in the business and people know you, Cincinnati and Boston and, of course, in St. Louis, and we want to know what you're doing today. But let's not leave this topic because it still sometimes is talked about today. When that happened, you could not have known what was about to hit you professionally, personally. Tell us, take the story from there. What occurred to you after that?
Right. I had no idea. I was at the time pushing the envelope. I mean, when you look like me, you got to be different. So I was doing a lot of crazy things on TV, and I just thought, this is one more gag I pulled off. And, you know, it shocked the people in the studio, and I went home, and I thought, that's it. But the response was far greater than I ever anticipated. Both major newspapers in Boston took notice of it, if you will say, you might say. Jack Craig was the longtime veteran TV radio writer for the Boston Globe, and he blasted me within 2 days in his column saying, this was so unprofessional. Can you believe what this man did on TV? This new guy at Channel 7, blah, blah, blah. So I thought the tabloid Boston Herald would be kinder because they were always trying to stir things up because they were way behind the Globe in circulation. But their TV radio guy was a guy named Jim Baker, and he didn't go for it either, much to my chagrin. In fact, he changed my name. He made Zip Was Up in my first and middle name. My last name became the man who smashed an egg in his face. So every time he ever wrote about me, it was Zip Was Up with the man who smashed an egg in his face. Wouldn't let it go.
Well, in researching part of the podcast, Zip, I can't find that video anywhere. It's not on YouTube. I don't know. Maybe it's hidden on somebody's server in the dark corners of the web. Is there some kind of copyright thing? Or I don't know why it's not out there.
Not that I know of, Dave. If this was the age of YouTube, would have gotten like a billion views. But
yes.
I don't have a copy of it. I don't know anybody who does. Although occasionally I'll run into people who were in Boston and saw it, or somebody in the industry that saw it through the years, and they'll comment on it. But I don't know anybody that has it on tape.
Who is your the male co-anchor at the time?
The male co-anchor was one Bill O'Reilly.
Like that Bill O'Reilly.
That Bill O'Reilly. He was doing the news. I was doing the sports. He was sitting right next to me.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Mr. O'Reilly because there is a personal relationship that Zip still shares with Bill to this day, which is kind of interesting. All right, so we'll kind of come back through that part of your life, but let's...
Before we leave that, O'Reilly did enjoy it. He was the one guy who enjoyed it. He was laughing. He totally unexpected, you know it. But he like threw me a towel and said, hey, that was great, but what are you going to eat for breakfast? And so he was yucking it up.
Well, you didn't last very much longer on that station, right?
No.
Did that have anything to do with that incident?
No, the station was sold and new ownership came in and they broomed all the executives who hired Bill O'Reilly and me and a bunch of others. And the new guys came in, we were in third place in a three-station market, and they fired numerous people, including O'Reilly and me.
How long were you unemployed?
Well, we were there 1 year. We all had one-year contracts. Uh-huh. And there were two-year contracts, one-year option. The new guys came in and exercised the option, and we were gone. So I was out of work for 5 months at that time before I came to St. Louis.
And you had an agent who was out looking at all the cities?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And so St. Louis was indeed your Channel 2.
Yes.
Was your stop. Okay. We'll get to that. But I want to go back to like the beginning, because I'm always fascinated by people's stories. Like, okay, I know what you do today, but how did you get there? What made you there? Why did you take that path? That's what I'm always curious about. That's what I'm fascinated about. So growing up, were you a big sports kid? Did you play every sport you could? Tell me about that growing up.
I grew up in Detroit, Dave. I was born in the city of Detroit, grew up in the suburbs of Detroit. But back in the 1950s, Detroit was a pretty booming town. It was the big motor city. It was before the foreign cars kind of took most of the market, and life was good. So I was a happy kid, middle-class family. I grew up playing Little League baseball and football and basketball and all that kind of stuff. I went to an all-boys Catholic high school, which is big into sports. I played basketball and I played football, and that's where I got the nickname Zip. I was not very big, but I had a strong arm. That was my gift. And I would rifle the ball to wide receivers, and the school newspaper decided that my name should be Zip Rezepa. And when you go to a school with 1,000 boys, all sports crazed, those nicknames stick.
So you were Christopher. That's your given name.
Okay. That's correct.
What's your middle name, by the way?
Edward.
Christopher Edward.
Yes.
And you have siblings?
I have two brothers, both younger.
Okay. And where are they today?
One's in suburban Texas outside of Fort Worth, and one's out of Nashville, outside of Nashville.
Did they get into sports as a profession or not?
No. My brother, who was a year and a half younger than me, took a totally different route. He didn't like sports at all, which was strange. I was into sports all the time. My dad was into sports all the time, but he went in a different direction. He was a musician and a computer kind of guy, different kind of brain. And my parents, I think, wisely let him go his own path. They didn't encourage him to force him into Little League or force him to do something he didn't want to do. And he took a different path. My younger brother is 8 years younger than me, so we were pretty far apart growing up. But he's a big sports fan. Big TCU Horned Frogs guy down there in Fort Worth.
So you are, you're playing every sport like a lot of young boys did at the time.
Sure.
What did you gravitate toward more?
Well, football was my best sport without question, but at 5'9", 160 pounds, I didn't want to get beat up playing sixth string on the freshman team or the varsity and getting killed every day in practice. So I decided to become a college basketball player, which was an incredible decision because I had no size, no speed, no quickness, no jumping ability.
Other than that,
I was pretty good.
Yeah, I bet. Where though? Where did you go?
I went to Boston University.
Okay.
And decided to try to make it as a walk-on. I decided Boston University for three reasons. Number one, I had a great journalism school. I was interested in becoming a journalist. Number two, I thought I might be able to make it as a walk-on in basketball, whereas if I went to UCLA or something, no shot. And number three, it was 55% women. And after going to an all-boys school, I said, oh, that's pretty good. I like that. I like those odds.
I get it. You know what I have found? A lot of people in the profession of the media and who make a name for themselves, when they're younger, a lot of times they're either maybe kind of the class clown, they're already outgoing, and that just obviously follows them through life. That's a part of their personality. But what I've also found is a lot of them will tell you, when I was younger, I was actually kind of shy. And all of that kind of stayed in me. And then I found my calling later on. Do you fit into either one of those categories?
Interesting question. I think I'm kind of a dichotomy. I have a pensive, contemplative side and yet an outgoing side. And I don't know. They're both kind of natural to me. I don't really think I wouldn't say it's impossible to be both, but different times of my life, different periods of my life, even moments of every day, I go flip-flop between one and the other.
So even at your biggest, when you were Zipper Zep, and I'm talking especially here in St. Louis, where you were recognized everywhere, did you need that time away? Did you need to say, I just want to be a loner now? Is that part of your personality too?
You know, honestly, Dave, I was such a workaholic when I was in TV throughout my 20 years and Monday through Friday and 25 years total in TV. I was such a workaholic that I really didn't allow myself that downtime. Mm. And I really regret that I didn't. You know, I was just working so hard, so many hours, so driven, so compelled to be the best and working till almost midnight every night of my life in all these different cities that I didn't allow myself that time. And I really regret that.
Yeah. You know, so you're at Boston University. By the way, did you make the team as a walk-on?
I did.
You did?
I did, yes.
And how much playing time?
Not much. I played 2 years. Played is a relative term.
But you made the team.
I made the team. If we were 25 up or 25 down, I'd get all excited because I knew I had a shot to get in. But I made the team and traveled, played at Boston Garden, actually got into a game at Boston Garden, which was nice. It wasn't our home court, but we're playing in a holiday tournament there and played there. So it was fun. It was fun.
So you were in the journalism school there. Did you want to go specifically to sports, or was news even on the horizon for you possibly?
It was always sports, Dave.
Okay.
But I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to write. When I was in high school, I was the sports editor of a high school newspaper. I wrote a column called Zip Strip, and it was all about sports, and I was the sports guy. So my goal when I went to Boston University was to become a sports writer, become a sports columnist, or write for Sports Illustrated, or write for a newspaper covering a sports team. But I fell in love with the immediacy of radio at the campus radio station when I started to do little 5-minute sports casts at the urging of a friend. friend. And then before I graduated, I was doing the color commentary and then finally the play-by-play of Boston University football. It was only on the campus radio station. Mm-hmm. So
got to start somewhere.
If you're more than two blocks away from campus, you couldn't have heard my broadcast. Yeah. But I fell in love with the immediacy of it mm-hmm. because you were broadcasting events as they were happening or shortly after they were happening if you're doing a sports cast. Whereas in writing, you wouldn't see your work until the next day if you're working for a daily or the next week or the next month if you're working for a periodical. So by the time I got out of Boston University, I decided to go the broadcast route.
So tell me then, what happened? Where did you start looking and what was your first job?
Well, like a lot of people, I started out at the bottom. Boston University, by the way, was an incredible experience. The broadcast division of Boston University was filled with incredibly talented people, young people, of course. They were college students. A couple of them were running the campus radio station, and I gradually got to know that their fathers were pretty bigwigs in New York. Mm-hmm. George Schweitzer's dad was a bigwig with CBS, and George himself became the director of communications for the CBS television network. Another was John Gambling, whose dad was in radio in New York, and he, John Gambling Jr., became one of the famous disc jockeys on WOR. His show, Rambling with Gambling, for decades was one of the top-rated shows in New York City. And then there were the guys like me who came with no pedigree, no contacts, no gravitas to make it in the business, but who wanted to do it. And some of us did. There was a guy who was a chubby guy who worked as a producer of the broadcast when I was doing the color commentary and play-by-play. His name was Eli Gold. And Eli Gold became the legendary radio voice of the Alabama Crimson Tide football team. He is still there 40 years. And when there's some big highlight on YouTube, sometimes they'll put his excited radio call over the video. And so Eli did well.
Yes. Now, I may have this wrong. Was Howard Stern through there too?
Then there were the two most famous guys who at that time were just guys like us trying to make it. Howard Stern and Bill O'Reilly were both on campus at the same time.
At Boston University.
At Boston University. Okay. So it's quite a collection of people at that time who would go on to greater things in broadcasting.
So your first job was where?
Fort Wayne, Indiana. When I graduated, I had no tape of anything. You had to make tapes back in those days. There wasn't any internet to put your stuff out. And I sent out resumes that I'd graduated from Boston University with a degree in journalism to 150 television stations, and no one was interested. So I took the initiative to send them another letter and say, I will travel at my own expense to audition on your set for a job as a sportscaster. And a station in Fort Wayne took me up on it. And I drove my rented Ford Pinto to Fort Wayne from my home in Detroit. And I did pretty well, I thought. And I drove back, and the news director said, I'll let you know in a few days what we think. So he called me and he said, well, we're going to offer you a job, but you're probably not going to take it. And I'm thinking, what do you mean not going to take it? To be on TV, I'd take it.
Yeah.
He said, well, it's only a one night a week job doing the sports on Saturday nights, and we can only pay you $40 a week to do it, and you're probably going to turn it down. I understand. And I thought, man, I'd be on TV. I'll take it. So for $40 a week, I drove my rented Ford Pinto to Fort Wayne, Indiana, holed up at the Days Inn for a few days until my news director, in sympathy, let me sleep on his couch until I found an apartment.
Oh, my.
And that was my beginning in TV.
Did you stay there and get more airtime, or did you have to go elsewhere?
No, Dave, I was only there 6 weeks because at that time, a station in Flint, Saginaw, Bay City, one of the stations who took me up on my opportunity to go and audition, called me 2 or 3 months after I had auditioned. And they said, hey, we got a full-time job for you Monday through Friday. I said, oh, man, I got to go. So I left Fort Wayne and headed to Flint, Saginaw, Bay City.
And this was what, early 70s,
mid-70s? Mid-70s, yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, that's how we all started. My story leaving Mizzou broadcast journalism in 1984, same thing. You know, we all did it, right? You send tapes out to as many stations. And it's so funny what you just said about writing a letter. I will drive anywhere. And I wrote the same thing. I remember sending a tape to Beaumont, Texas. And I'm in St. Louis. That's not a quick drive. I had a 69 3 on the tree AMC Rambler. And I said, I will drive down to Beaumont. And the news director is almost pleading with me, don't do it. I'm like, was my tape that bad? And so I didn't take no for an answer. I said, no, you have my tape. I'm driving down there. And I made some excuse that I was on my way over to Houston to visit a friend, which I did have a friend there and I ended up seeing him, but that's not the main reason to get me down there. And the news director was nice and he showed me around, but they didn't even have an opening. So, but you do what you can. And my first job was in Hays, Kansas in late 84 and through 85. And I made $10,100 my first year. And all the hours that I put in, I did the math, and even back then was slightly below the poverty level. But like you said, Zip, I didn't care. I didn't know. I didn't say, woe is me. I didn't come from money anyway. And so it didn't, you learn to eat beanie weenies. And I did that in college anyway. And then you kind of move up the ranks. So you're in the Saginaw area, and then take us from there.
Okay. I was there for 3 years and it was a great experience because I could be on the air 5 days a week. And that's really where my career took a change for the better. Every summer or whenever I had a vacation, I would get in my car and drive to a major city, take my tapes with me because now I had lots of tapes, lots of material. And I'd beg my way in for a meeting with a news director. I'd say, you know, what do I have to do to work here? And they'd give me some advice. Well,
had you developed the Zip style yet? Were you zany or anything?
No.
You didn't have the Zippo Awards or nothing like that?
Nothing like that. I was just pretty a straight sports guy reading the scores and doing the highlights. So I took my tape to Philadelphia one day on my vacation. I went to the East Coast, looked at the big cities there. And I got into Channel 3, which is a big station, Westinghouse broadcast station there. And a guy named Ken Tiven was the news director. And I brought my tape in, as I always did. And I said, okay, take a look. And he says, okay. So he took a look at the tape and I said, well, what do you think? He goes, what do I think? I think, son, if you ever get a job in a major market, you will be the ugliest TV sportscaster in
Are
town.
Are you serious?
That's what he said.
That's
stunned.
Classic.
I didn't know what to say, Dave.
I wonder, could a news director say that today without maybe—
Probably not today.
Yeah.
But this was like 1970s. They could say whatever they wanted.
You'd be the ugliest person in what are you, in
the ugliest TV sportscaster in town if you ever make it to a major market. And I thought, uh-oh. So I tried to gather my composure and I said, well, what can I do to make it? He said, if I were you, I'd be different. I said, well, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, look, your looks are never going to help you, son. But he said, you know, there's a guy in New York who has a really fast-paced show. He uses a lot of video. And there's a guy out in L.A. who has a great rapport with the anchors. And there's a guy in Washington who's really funny. He's a sportscaster. He throws a lot of humor into it. And if I were you, I'd be different. So I said, okay. So I drove my car all the way back to Saginaw, Michigan, where I could experiment because it was a smaller market. And I started to become different. I started pushing the envelope and experimenting and doing fist-pounding commentaries and crazy stuff out in the field and putting humor in and doing all kinds of stuff, keeping what seemed to work and throwing out what didn't. But I was pushing it there for 3 years in Saginaw, and that really shaped my career.
You know, that story, and I don't mean to get off on a tangent, but this just hit me. As offensive as that was, no question, and I'm sure it hurt you. And like we just said, I don't know if you could get away with it today. But we are a society now that doesn't allow that kind of thing. It doesn't allow direct criticism. But Zip, that turned out to be some of the best advice you ever got. And I don't know if you're sitting here today, if he didn't give you that kind of advice. It started out with maybe a hurtful direct comment on your looks, but then he went from there to say, but this is how you can do it.
Yes. It was the most helpful thing I ever got in the broadcasting business, the most helpful advice, no question. And I probably wouldn't be here today. I probably would have gone back. And if he just said, well, it looks okay, you know, good luck.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have changed. I wouldn't have pushed the envelope. I would have just been reading the scores and never would have made it to a major town.
So did you go to Cincinnati right after that? Or was there another stop?
Okay. I went to Cincinnati after that. I started bicycling my tapes around my different stuff, and it created quite a stir. So I knew I was in the right track. Mm. a vice president of NBC News, Bill Slatterer in Chicago, is kind of an agent for the NBC affiliates. And he said, "You're going to make it, son." And I was like stunned. I didn't know if I was ever going to make it. You know, I said, "Really?" He goes, "Oh, yeah." He says, "I got 200 tapes of sports guys on my desk, and they're all the same. They're all really good looking, and they have really good voices."
It goes back to your looks again.
Right, again.
It's funny.
But he said, "Son, you are an original. You're going to make it. I'm going to help you." So all of a sudden, I was a finalist for his station in Minneapolis and in Dallas. And all he was bicycling my tape around, doing all my work for me. And I just missed on those jobs. And then he says, "There's a guy in Cincinnati that just loves you." And I said, "Okay." He says, "A good news director." So I thought, well, Cincinnati's a little bigger than, smaller than Dallas, but it's a lot bigger than Saginaw. Mm-hmm. So I took the job there as sports director. I was 27 years old, sports director of the NBC TV affiliate in Cincinnati, which at that time had the Big Red Machine and Cincinnati Bengals and Xavier and UC basketball and all kinds of stuff, which is a big jump from Saginaw, where I was covering frisbee tournaments and free throw shoots and skateboarding and stuff like
dog
that.
Dog shows, yeah.
Right.
So I just thought about this because you just mentioned this. As me being such a big baseball fan, and I grew up in that era with the Big Red Machine. So you were there during one of the most iconic eras in baseball in that city. So tell me about that team and some of those players. That had to have been a blast.
Well, I was there the last year the Big Red Machine made the playoffs, 1979.
Got it.
I wasn't there when they won the championships in 74 and 70, or 75 and 76.
Right.
So, but I was there in 79. Pete Rose had gone to Philadelphia, but Joe Morgan was still around, and Davey Concepcion was playing shortstop. Johnny Bench was still there, and George Foster, and a lot of great, great players, Tony Perez. And it was just an incredible era and so exciting for me to be in the clubhouse with all those guys.
Now, you're at Cincinnati, but you probably still had a hunger. I can still go farther, right? So are you still sending out tapes?
Sure, sure. And after 2 years, my contract ran out and the station wanted me to sign a 3-year contract. But I was full of pride. I thought, man, I'm in my 20s. I'm doing well here and things are going well in Cincinnati. I can do better than that. I don't want to lock into 3 more years.
How much are you making?
I was making $30,000.
Okay, good. Good money.
Enough to live on back in 1980 or so. Yep. Yeah. So I was sports director, but I didn't want to stay for another 3 years. So contract expired. I worked without a contract for a few months and, we just couldn't get it together. And finally, they got tired of my reluctance to sign a 3-year deal. And they said, okay, you're done. So that was it.
So you were actually let go.
Yep.
And you're unemployed. Yep. And then tell me about that gap and where you went from there. How did that happen?
Well, what saved me was the Cincinnati Bengals had a tremendous season in 1981. They made it to the Super Bowl for the first time in their history. So as I was about to go out the door in TV, I wrote a song called The Ballad of the Bengals.
Well, of course you did.
Put it out in a 45, a little studio produced it and marketed it in an amazing way. I took it to all the convenience stores in town. And I said, hey, I got this record. Put it on the counter. It's $2 back in those days. People would buy it as a Christmas gift because it was going into Christmas and the Bengals were rocketing toward the playoffs. And they did. And I made enough money to live off that record for the many months of unemployment that followed when the station let me go.
Really? So you had revenue coming in for a little bit. Yep. Okay.
If you Google it, that is on YouTube. The Ballad of the Bengals by Zip Rezepa.
Ballad of the Bengals by Zip Rezepa. I am going to listen to that after this podcast. So how long were you unemployed? And did you go right to Boston? Was that your next gig?
It was, but it was 9 long months of unemployment later before I got to Boston.
Okay. And tell me about that process. I mean, were there other stations involved or was that it? It was just, that was the one offer and you took it.
Well, all those times I was taking my station, taking my tapes around and sending them out. And I got a couple weekend jobs, but I didn't want to become a weekend guy because I'd been the Monday through Friday guy, the sports director in Cincinnati. So I didn't want to go, so to speak, backwards or lock myself into a station where the guys Monday through Friday were icons and were going to be there for 20, 30 years.
And as you know, you get labeled. I know I was the weekend guy. That stays with you. That's hard to break.
So I didn't want to do that. So I held out. And finally, I got a job in Boston. I had an agent in New York with the Beanstalk Corporation, a big corporate representation of sports guys and news guys and famous people. And Bill Applegate was a news director in San Francisco, and he had turned around a number three station, turned it into a powerhouse. So Boston hired him at a number three station to do the same thing. So I called my agent. I said, "Hey, Bill Applegate just got that job in Boston. You know, send him my tape." And my agent said, "I don't think you're Bill Applegate's kind of guy. I'm going on vacation for a couple of weeks. I'll think about it when I get back." So I thought, I can't. I'm desperate. I'm hungry. Yeah. I'm starving. So I sent him a tape and a booklet that I prepared of all the press clippings I'd gotten, all kinds of stuff. And I sent it to Bill Applegate personally in this giant thing about the size of a pizza box, so he couldn't ignore it, with a tape inside.
Was the 45 of the Ballad of the Bengals in there?
Oh, it was, to show how creative I was. Yes.
Wow. Okay.
2 days later, I get a call from Bill Applegate. He says, "You know, I think you better come and talk to us. We're interested in you." So I flew to Boston. He hired me that day. I flew back to St. Louis, and that was it.
And the number of the size of the market was—
the sixth biggest market in the country.
Wow, you're in the
time.
Sixth biggest market.
Yep.
Now you're in the area where New York knows who's in Boston.
Yep.
ESPN knows who's at the big. So you're thinking Boston may not even be the end of it, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. You are in a top market, and this was
82.
Okay. What was the sports scene at the time like?
It was great in basketball. It was Larry Bird against Magic Johnson.
Yeah.
The beginning of the rivalry, early in the rivalry. So I was just delighted to be courtside watching Larry Bird and Magic Johnson battle in the NBA championship series and all this stuff. Also, it was the last season of Carl Yastrzemski, of his Hall of Fame career, who played every year with the Boston Red Sox, Hall of Famer, 3,000 hits, everything. So I got to cover Yaz in his final goodbye to baseball, was exciting.
Of all the four major sports just in Boston, your favorite sports guy to cover, your favorite sports person to interview was who?
It wasn't Carl Yastrzemski. He was kind of, you know, he'd seen
aloof,
a million young sports
yeah.
guys. He was kind of aloof. He just, so it wasn't him. And it wasn't Larry Bird, because he was kind of the same way.
Right.
He didn't have much respect for the media, or didn't want to chat and be a funny guy or anything. But I think the hockey guys were the best. Ray Bourque was playing for the Bruins then, and he was great. And Rick Middleton, and the Bruins had some pretty good players.
Mm-hmm.
So Brad Park had come over from the Rangers, and so they were a fun team. The hockey guys are always the best guys in sports, in my opinion, of all the major sports, by far.
Zip, there is no question. Now, when I was doing sports with you at Channel 4, which we'll get to, but unfortunately, we didn't have a football team. The Big Red had just left, and I left the industry before we got the Rams. Of course, we didn't have an NBA team, so it was just the Blues and the Cardinals as your major sports teams. And I fell in love with hockey. I always liked hockey, and I loved the Blues from the moment they started in the late 60s in St. Louis, but covering them, that became my favorite sport because of the players. Look, these are a bunch of, mainly back then, especially Canadian farm boys.
Right.
And they were playing a kid's game, and they knew it, and they didn't care. And you could go in the locker room and sit and joke around with them. And this isn't true for all baseball players. I don't mean to be overgeneralizing here, but you would find a lot of the baseball players were coddled from when they were little.
Yes.
They were the stars of their little league team, and they were coddled in high school and college, and then they were drafted, and now they're coddled. And they were a different group, and they were very hard a lot of times to talk to. Now, there are exceptions, like here in town, a Ken Daly, even a Jose Oquendo, Ricky Horton, people like that. Adam Wainwright today apparently seems like a good guy, of course, after my time. But the hockey players have always been the best.
Yep, yep. So I enjoyed the Bruins.
Yeah.
The Bruins are great. Yeah.
So now let's kind of quickly bypass the story that I started with. We already know the egg story. And then shortly after that, they kind of cleaned house. But I'm interested in the whole Bill O'Reilly thing. And we can even jump ahead and go back and forth. But I think people are going to be somewhat surprised, especially those who have watched you on television for a long time and they know you as this fun-loving, happy-go-lucky guy who just loves what he does for a living. It always showed on TV. Genuinely nice guy. Anyone who's ever met you in person always says the same thing. And then there's Bill O'Reilly. Now, I'm not going to go either way. You know this. You're a friend of his. People love Bill O'Reilly or they can't stand Bill O'Reilly.
Right.
Either side, I think he'd be the first person to even admit, he's kind of got an ego. He's very sure of himself. Obviously, very political. He may not have been that starting out, but that's what his show became. Why are you guys to this day such good friends when at least on the surface, it looks like that you have such disparate personalities that yet you're joined at the hip in so many ways?
Yeah, we're very close friends, have been for more than 40 years. We do have a lot of things in common. Bill is a big, big sports fan. He loves sports. So I was a sports guy, and I love sports. I still do to this day. And so we'd always talk about sports, and that kind of brings people together. He was an Irish Catholic guy, so we'd go to Mass together. And when working the nights, and we didn't have much time to date, so we would double date together back in those days. And we were both interested in the women. We were two young single guys in the city of Boston.
But you were the ugly guy, right? Everyone right. told
I just rode on O'Reilly's coattails. Hey, Bill, can you get us a couple of double dates?
Funny.
Can you find two for us, Bill?
But do you still... maybe he started this, but you and Bill and a group of other friends have had this annual vacation to exotic places around the world. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's called the Men of Adventure Tour, and it's a bunch of 20 guys handpicked by Bill O'Reilly from all kinds of walks of life. Before he went into broadcasting, after he graduated from college, he taught high school in Miami for 2 years. So one of the guys who was his teaching fellow is one of the guys in the trip. He went to Marist, and two or three of the guys were his college buddies. And then he went to Boston University and got a master's. He went to Harvard and got another master's, and a couple guys there came along. And he worked in different markets in TV, working his way up like the rest of us. By the way, he started in Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah, wow.
You were in Hayes, Kansas. I was in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Yeah.
Bill was in Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, Pennsylvania.
We all started low. You have to do that. By the way, where did he go after Boston? Did he go right to First Edition?
No. When he and I were let go at Boston at the same time, we're on the beach looking for work, he wound up in Portland, Oregon.
Hmm.
Because, again, it was the only place you could get a job. There were only three stations in town in those days. When you got fired, you weren't going to go to one of the other stations in town. So he had a look, and all the markets were tight, and he wound up in Portland. So I had a bigger jump to St. Louis, although it took me 9 months. He got to Portland. He stayed, I think, a year or two as the main anchor. And then he went to, where'd he go from there? I think he went to Dallas. And he was the movie critic in Dallas.
Are you kidding
me? Yeah, he was the entertainment movie critic in Dallas, which is a much bigger market, you know, and he had a sense of humor, and he was developing as a broadcaster and letting it out a little bit. And then he went to New York. He got a network job as a correspondent with ABC World News Tonight as one of the lower end, you know, network guys, but he was on the air. And then he went to CBS. He worked with Dan Rather under him. And then he worked as a weekend anchor at WCBS in New York.
So he really was developing his chops there.
Oh, I
didn't realize that
he had all those jobs along the way,
And I said First Edition. I meant Inside Edition. That's the first time that I really saw him.
Right. So after those local gigs in TV and the network gigs, Inside Edition offered him a job as the main correspondent. And David Frost was the original host of Inside Edition. He lasted 3 weeks and decided to go back to England, and they promoted O'Reilly to that job.
I did not know that story.
Yeah. So he was the host of Inside Edition for 7 years. And then Roger Ailes became the man that Rupert Murdoch hired to start the news division of Fox News in 1996. It didn't exist. It was a new network. Murdoch brought in Roger Ailes to assemble a group of professionals in the news business to do Fox News. And Ailes knew him from New York and Inside Edition and different things, and hired Bill to do the primetime show, The O'Reilly Factor. The first year is called the O'Reilly Report, and they changed the name to the O'Reilly Factor. And within 4 years, he'd gone from zero viewers, literally, the new network, to number one. And then from his fourth year to his 20th year, he was number one in cable. Nobody could.
Whatever happened to Fox News? Did they make it? I think they
did,
didn't they?
They're still around.
I think they're even kind of in the news these days.
Yeah.
Not always for reasons they want. We're not touching that subject. We're having fun here. We're just talking. So back to you, Zip, and your career path. You get to St. Louis. You're hired by Channel 2, which at the time was the ABC affiliate.
That's correct. Fox didn't exist, the local. Right,
right. And that was what year?
1984.
Okay. And you are there how many years? Because you then, this doesn't happen. You eventually jump ship within the same market. How did that occur?
That's interesting. I just came to love St. Louis. You know, I bounced around all these cities. I thought I'd be here for a couple of years, and I really liked it. So I had a two-year deal, re-signed with Channel 2 for two more years. And when that contract was running out, my agent said, you know, you're really hot. You got a great Q rating. You know, I can get you pretty much anywhere. I said, no, I really like St. Louis. I want to stay here. And he said, well, okay, you know, everybody in St. Louis would like to have you. And it became a three-way bidding service, bidding auction for my services. My agent in
New
York.
That has to make you feel good, right?
It was heady time.
Yeah.
I had a new agent by the time who loved me, Art Kaminsky. And Art would play one against the other against another. And he said, you know, here are the ground rules. You know, it's going to be a no-cut deal. It's going to be 5 years. Going to be $100,000 signing bonus. Who's in? And this is like unheard of in the 1980s for somebody in a local, especially a sports guy. I wasn't even a news guy. And so anyway, I jumped from Channel 2 to Channel 4, signed a 5-year contract.
What year was that?
1988.
Okay, yeah.
So I was 4 years at Channel 2 and then came to Channel 4 in 1988.
That was about the time, I think, it was KMOX TV. And they became KMOV TV.
Yeah,
about that time.
They had just changed before I got there.
Yeah.
And they've had a number of ownership changes.
Yes, they have. Oh, my gosh. So, Zip, when that happened, was there any animosity at all? Did you ever feel it? Because I think, weren't you making more than the news anchors when you first came over? Did you ever sense that? Was that an issue for you professionally?
It wasn't, but it was true. I was making more than the news anchors, which is absurd. The sports guy's on air for 4 minutes of the 30-minute show.
Yeah.
The news anchors are the ones that bring in the ratings and, you know, that everybody has to rely on to know what's going on in the world back then before the internet. So it was a way kind of embarrassing, but they just said, don't say anything about it. So I never really told anybody what I was making and nobody really brought it up.
Yeah, good. So shortly,
now, it wasn't an easy move because I had a 6-month non-compete clause with Channel 2, and they went to court to enforce it.
Oh.
So I was off the air for 6 months, unable to work after I signed the contract with Channel 4.
You know, in St. Louis media, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but this just dawned on me. In the mid-80s especially, the media really changed. We were kind of this, we were flyover country at the time and all the exciting stuff with the Howard Sterns of the world and were happening on the coast. And a guy named J.C. Corcoran comes in, becomes a big name. Franco Pinion starts his show. Zip Rezepa now, we've never seen this wacky, crazy sports stuff. Have you ever reflected on that time that when you got here, kind of a staid, old-fashioned Midwestern market, but within a few years, because of people like a J.C. Corcoran and a Zip Rezepa, all of a sudden, we're becoming like some of the bigger markets.
Yeah, it was a time when things were really changing in St. Louis. I was scared to death when I came here, Dave, you know. I didn't have a long contract after I'd gotten fired in Boston. I was out of work for 5 months that time, and I came here, and I was in my little hotel room waiting to go to work at Channel 2, and I turned on the other stations to see where the competition was, and man, they were so traditional, so buttoned down, so just read the scores and, you know, all this. I thought, man, this is what St. Louis is used to. That ain't me. That can't be me.
Get ready, folks.
If they fire me here, you know, I'll be in Anchorage, Alaska, you know, next stop. So I was scared. I didn't know if St. Louis was ready for it.
What's so funny, because I started off talking about the egg on the face story, and then I find out as I'm graduating Mizzou and looking for work, that guy was just hired by Channel 2 in St. Louis. Holy cow. But little did I know even though I tried because I wanted to get back in town, as I was starting my career in Kansas, and I went to Wichita with a quick stop down to Tyler, Texas in between there. And my dream, I got hired by Channel 4, and I'm a news guy. But I got to know you at that time because, as you would find out, I was such a big sports nut myself.
You wrote a book on the Blues.
Yes, I did. And so I got to know Doug Vaughn and you and others. And then this guy named Gary Apple leaves. So you've got this opening. And you had a weekend sports opening for quite some time. And I remember you even showing me some tapes. You're like, okay, look at this guy. This is why I don't like him. And look at this guy. This is why I don't. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Never thought anything about it because, you know, I've got my news thing. That's what I'm doing. And it was Doug Vaughn who told me on a, he and I both went on a trip up to Columbia because Norm Stewart and the Missouri basketball program was in trouble by the NCAA. This was in 1990. So he went up to cover it for sports. I went up there to cover it for news. And we were talking about this sports opening that you couldn't seem to find anyone to take the place. And Doug said, you should talk to Zip about it. You should maybe try to see if you can do it. I'm like, I'm a news guy. That's what I've done for 5 years so far. But then I went home and I talked to my wife and I said, I got this epiphany after talking to Doug Vaughn. I'm a sports guy in my hometown. I got to talk to Zip about it. So long story short, you may not even remember any of the details on this. They're a little fuzzy to me, but I had to, even at my own station where I was employed, I had to apply for the job. I had to get on the set with Larry Connors and Julius Hunter and pretend like I was doing sports. And it was right after that, Al Holzer, the news director at the time, said, do you want the job? And I said, yeah, and the rest is history. Do you remember that time little Dave Simons went over to sports?
And, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Your thoughts at the time were like, all that time I was looking for a guy and he's in my backyard right here.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know you were interested in sports.
Yeah.
I thought you were the news guy.
Yeah, I know. That's what I thought too. And I tell you, I wouldn't change that for the world, Zip. I mean, you had mentioned you got to St. Louis and you loved it. As a native, I was pinching myself. I mean, I got to know my idols growing up were Lou Brock and Bob Gibson. And to think that I got to play golf with Lou Brock.
Wow.
And the Bob Gibson, I have to tell the Bob Gibson story because we've talked about this before. You may not recall this, but Bob Gibson was in town. I don't remember, summer of 91, 92, whenever this was. And you said, Dave, go over to Busch Stadium and see if you can get Bob to come on live for either the 5 or 6 during the sports, and I'll interview him. Like, Bob Gibson's back in town. Because after he retired, he went back to Omaha, and that's where he lived.
Right.
And so I'm kind of this naive guy going over there. I knew Bob's reputation on the mound, but I didn't know that he sometimes could be surly with the media. Naivete is bliss, right? So I didn't know, walking in the lion's den. And maybe you did, and you knew, and you didn't care. You're like, watch Simons go over there and get his head chewed off. So I walk over there, and this was before a night game, and I find Bob sitting in the dugout with Red Shandings. And I kind of knew Red a little bit, not real well, but enough because I was hanging around the stadium all the time. And I'm just standing there, and I'm awkward, and I'm looking around. I'm like, between us, here's Bob, and here's Red, and they're sitting in the dugout, and I'm on the top of the steps, and I'm wanting to interrupt the conversation, but I had enough respect. I didn't know what to do. And finally, Bob says, excuse me, Red, can we help you? Like, hi, Bob. I'm Dave Simons. I'm with Channel 4 Sports, and my sports director, Zip Rezepa, wants to know if he could interview you live coming up in the 5 o'clock sports. And I'll never forget Bob's response. He goes, what's a Zipper Zeppa? Red's just kind of like this. He's kind of smiling a little bit because he knew who you were. What's a Zipper Zeppa? I go, it's Zip Rezepa. And he's the sports director and the anchor at the 5 and 6 o'clock. And whatever time you have, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, if you could just give us a minute. And he looked at Red and he goes, what do you think? should I do it? And Red goes, yeah, they're good guys. Bob goes, okay, I'll do it. Do the 5 o'clock. So you interview him live. I come, when I told you, you were surprised. You kind of acted surprised. You're like, oh.
I was.
Like, I sent you over there knowing that you were going to get your head chewed off, but I get to interview him. And I'll never forget, I think it was Malcolm Briggs. I think it was someone at Channel 5 even said, how did you get Bob Gibson? I'm like, I don't know. I just went over and asked, and Red said it was okay. So anyway,
that's a great story.
Yeah, that's just part of, again, that St. Louis kid who's pinching himself, now talking to the people that he idolized. And Zip, you'll recall even the other sports team at the time, the Blues, Hall & Oates, Brendan
huge.
Shanahan,
huge.
Brian Sutter, Curtis Joseph. We had Scott Stevens all too briefly. I mean, this was a Stanley Cup contender. Yep. Those were great times, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. So much fun. So much fun.
Yeah. I eventually left. This isn't my story. We'll get back to Zip. So I start my financial advisory career in 94. So coming up on 30 years there. But you stayed at Channel 4 as sports director for how much longer?
From 1988 to 1995. So 7 years.
So right after I left then. So in 95. Were you, but didn't you come back doing some other part-time, or were you still doing some Zippos or something?
I continued to do the Zippos for 6 more years.
Oh, okay. That's what I
remember. From 1995 to 2001. So I was still employed by Channel 4. I was still in the building, you know, at least one day a week and doing the Zippos on Friday nights.
And Steve Savard was the sports guy at the time.
Yes.
Tell me about the Zippos. Where did they start? How did they start? Because that's really... That was must-see TV here in St. Louis on Friday night for a long time.
David, to this day, I can't tell you how many people have come out to me and say, hey, the Zippo Awards, hey, you know, we used to watch on Friday night. Dad used to let me stay up and watch and all that stuff. So it actually evolved. It started in Saginaw, Michigan. I saw a guy in New York, Warner Wolf, do the best plays of the week.
Warner Wolf, oh, yeah.
I used to watch the best guys in the country. That, again, as I was a kid, when I was a kid broadcaster in Fort Wayne and Saginaw, I used to get tapes of guys in bigger markets. I said, I'll try to learn from them. Warner Wolf was one of my favorites in New York. He was huge. He was a sports director there for 40 years. And he used to do the best plays of the week, and he'd show all these great catches and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And I said, oh, that's a good idea. So I started to do that in Saginaw. And then just on a whim, in the middle of all these guys making great catches and everything, I showed a guy dropping an easy pop-up, and everybody laughed. I said, oh, look at that. That's not the best play. So I said, oh, that's pretty good. So the next week, I made it the best and worst plays of the week. And so then it was a little more colorful because I put guys, you know, running into the wall, dropping the ball, you know, tripping over the foul line, all kinds of stuff. And then one day I put the San Diego Chicken in there, who was a big mascot at that time, one of the first funny, humorous mascots in sports. And he was goofing up on the field and everybody roared at that. They thought it was really funny. So I made it the best, worst, and weirdest plays of the week. So when I got the job in Boston, I took that idea with me. And we had a young producer named Michael Glantz, who was my producer, and he loved it. He said, this is great. We'll put some music under this. So he found the song called Root Beer Rag by Billy Joel.
Yeah.
He says, this is great music. This will be perfect for it. We'll run this underneath it. I said, okay, great. So it was the best, worst, and weirdest plays of the week with Billy Joel underneath it. And then he said, you know, this needs a name. Let's call it the Zippo Awards. I said, okay.
Oh, so it was someone else who came up with that name.
Yeah. So I said, okay, that sounds good. And so it became the Zippo Awards. So by the time I came to St. Louis, I pretty much had it knocked down. And the music was there, the name was there, the idea of best, worst, and weirdest was there. And so we started out right by the time we got in Boston or to St. Louis, right out of the gate, we started doing that on Friday nights. So it became very popular very, very fast.
Yes.
So there's the news director at Channel 2 is Wayne Thomas and all that stuff. And they had big things like, well, should we do it on Friday nights? Friday night isn't a big news night, you know, but this is so popular. Should we move it to like Thursday or Monday when they have big lead-ins and everything else? And the consensus was, no, we got to do it at 10 o'clock. And then they were getting all kinds of mail that the kids wanted to stay up to watch it and everything. Says, should we do it at 6 o'clock? And the GM and the news director had a big powwow. They said, no, make them stay up. Make them stay till 10 o'clock. It'd be a good lead into the weekend and the Monday broadcast. So it always was on Friday night.
So. Zip, of all your years in the business, what is something that you hated about it? Something that, was it the business side of it? Was it the fact that you didn't have a personal life? What was it?
Definitely that I didn't have a personal life. The business side was tough. I mean, it was amazingly competitive. I mean, your job was always on the line. You know, every quarter a new rating book would come out. And, you know, now when I got the 5-year no-cut guaranteed contract, I didn't have that pressure. But until then, working my way up in all those markets, there was always pressure and competition and everything else. But the personal side of it was by far the worst thing about it. And it was so hard because I was a workaholic, as I admitted. I was working, and you know, these days, if the guys started doing a Sunday night show, they would take Friday and Saturday off. Not me, because I was doing the Zippos on Friday night. So I was doing Monday through Friday, 5, 6, and 10. Saturday morning, when the Big Red was in town, when I was working in Cincinnati covering the Bengals, I'd be getting on a plane 8 Saturdays in the fall, flying with a football team out of town for the next day's game on Sunday, doing the post game, coming back and doing a Sunday night show, waking up on Monday morning and starting all over again. So I was working 7 days a week, almost every week in the fall, 6 days a week at a minimum, because it was Monday through Friday plus Sunday night. And I had no life. Mm-hmm. I had no life. And it was lonely. I mean, I'd get off and again, being a workaholic, I'd watch my show. I'd watch the other guys' shows. I'd think about what to do the next day. I'd never leave before 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. You know, then I'd be hungry. So I'd go to the only two places that were open in town, Uncle Bill's and IHOP, get something to eat, go home, go to bed at 2 or 3 in the morning, get up like at 9, you know. And I was happy in that I was successful. I was making a lot of money. I had a nice home and a nice car, all those things. Now I had security with a longer term contract.
You always threw a great Super Bowl party, by the way. Those were fun.
Thank you. But I had no life. I mean, at 9 o'clock in the morning, what I wanted to do was get married and have a wife and a family. And I get up at 9 a.m. I go, okay, I guess I'll, where are all the women? Oh, that's right. They're at work. It's 9 o'clock. I guess I'll go for a run. So I'd run a few miles and I'd take a shower. And then it'd be like noon. I go, okay, better start having lunch and getting ready for the day in sports. And I'd be reading the two newspapers and all that stuff. And it was just that I love the job. I love the challenge. I love everything about it, Dave, the creativity of it, the writing, the producing, the being different, trying to beat the other guys, the competitive nature of it. I loved every bit of it. But what it took away from me was life.
Yeah.
I just had no personal life, no way to find anybody to date, no way to have a normal relationship with as friends or anything. My life was my work.
Well, you wouldn't change anything, would you? Or would you?
I think I would.
Really?
I
mean,
when I reflect on that, I was 20 years, you know, working till midnight every night in five different cities at 6 different stations. And I do have regrets. I probably would change it and pull back. And that's really why I got out when I did in 1995. I said, I can't take this anymore. I was 43 years old in my prime. And I just said, I can't take this anymore. So I developed a way out where I formed a radio show, a syndicated radio show. Yeah. And I thought, that will be my ticket out. That's what I'll do. It'll be a 3-hour show on Saturday mornings, no more nights, one day a week. That's it. And I'll have a life. So that was my escape plan from TV. And I was all excited about it because I would have a life. And we put a lot of effort into that show. It was called The Great American Sports Trivia Show. We ran around the country. We got it in 57 cities. But in our naivete, we didn't know that it wasn't a national advertising buy unless you were in 200 cities. Mm-hmm. And we lost the war to get it to 200 cities. The show only lasted 9 months, and it went off the air. And when that happened, Dave, I had put all the money I'd ever saved into that show, and I lost everything I had. Mm-hmm. So it's funny. I mean, in 1995, I had everything the world says is important. I was on TV. I was famous. I was making a lot of money. I was living in a beautiful home. I was driving a very expensive car. I was vacationing in Europe, wearing designer clothes. 1 year later, I had given up my job in TV, lost my job in radio, lost all the money I'd ever saved, lost my fiance, who at that time I had developed a fiance in the year I got out, the engagement broke off, and my dad was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, all in the space of 1 year. I went from 1 year of having everything the world says important to being devastated in every aspect of my life.
That's even worse than a country song that puts all the bad stuff in one song.
Didn't get trains in there.
But. Well, I know. Zip, so you are a very strong faith-based man, Catholic through and through, which we'll get to because that's part of your story, what you're doing today. How did you lean on your faith or did you find yourself at that time starting to drift away or did that anchor you?
No, it anchored me because when that show went off the air, I suddenly had no job, no money, no fiancé. I had nothing. You know, I was still at my house hanging on. That was about it. I was scrambling to make a living. I was doing some commentary on WIL radio 3 days a week. I was still doing the Zip Awards, so they pay me a little money there. So I had some income coming in to keep the house, but that's all I had. I had anything to do every day. And I was like, you know, what do I do? The only thing I've done all my life is the sports on TV. That is not good training for any profession. So I thought, what am I going to do? And that's where my faith really saved me. It's funny. It was God's grace. God gets all the credit for this. I got a phone call from a priest I had never known, never heard from, didn't know who he was. And he said, I'd like you to help me do some evangelization in the inner city of St. Louis. I said, whoa, I'm no evangelist, Father. I'm Catholic, but I'm no evangelist. He says, why don't you come out and see me? I said, okay. So he gave me directions to his place, and I went out to see him. Drove out 44 to Beaumont Antire Road, got off that exit, went past the Boy Scout camp, drove through the winding roads for 4 or 5 miles until I came to this strange place in the woods. It was called Mary the Font Solitude. And I turned down this dirt road to where he gave me directions. And it was 110 acres of rolling land. And on the trees were pictures of Jesus, the Stations of the Cross. And I drove down the road and there were these little hermitages, these huts in the valley up on cinder blocks, little tiny 8x10 buildings where people were living as hermits out in the woods, 100 feet apart from each other.
Really?
So I kept driving and I came to what looked like
it sounds like cultish, like some dystopian movie or something.
It was very, very strange. Yeah. Dirt road, my tires were kicking up dust. It was the summertime. And I got to a little A-frame building, looked like a chapel, and saw a couple of cars parked outside. So I parked my car, got out of my car, and started walking toward the chapel. And I see this priest in a blue cassock and a collar walking toward me. He says, hey, I'm Father Placid. Thanks for coming. Come on in. So he takes me into his office up on cinder blocks. There's nothing but a table, a couple of chairs, and a crucifix on the wall. And he says, okay, if you want to be a part of this, you got to do 5 things. I said, okay, go ahead, shoot, Father. He says, okay, the first thing is you got to go to Mass every day. I said, every Sunday. He goes, no, every day.
Yeah.
I said, okay. He says, you got to do 10 minutes of spiritual reading every day. The third thing is you got to do 30 minutes of meditative prayer in silence and solitude every day. The fourth thing is you got to come out here every Saturday for a 90-minute meeting of kind of group spiritual direction. And then the fifth thing is we're going to send you with a partner into the most crime-ridden, drug-infested areas of St. Louis where no one wants to go. We're going to ask you to get out of your car, knock on doors, and ask people if they'd like to learn more about the Catholic faith.
You're thinking, where do I sign up?
I'm thinking, so.
Oh, my gosh.
The Holy Spirit at work, Dave. A minute, about 10 seconds later, I said, okay, Father, let's give that a shot. And as soon as I said that, I thought, where did that come from? I have no interest in doing this. But it was the Holy Spirit at work calling me to do that work. And that's where my deepening of faith and spirituality began.
Tell me about the first time then going into these areas and doing that work.
it was an experience. They gave me some training with somebody who had done it before for 2 or 3 weeks, took me around with a person who had done that before, and then they assigned me my partner. My partner was a little guy from Dublin, Ireland, who had been miraculously cured of multiple sclerosis at Lourdes, France. He had come to this country with his children and in gratitude decided to serve the poor the rest of his life. So they hooked me up with him as my partner. His name was Declan Duffy. So we drive down to the inner city. He's never done this before either. We park the car and they assign us the streets and they show us where they want to go. And they intentionally pick parts where nobody ever goes to evangelize. So we got out of our car, went up to the first house. The window shades were all closed in all these houses because there was so much drug trafficking in these houses. So we rang the doorbell and we saw the shades go up like this. We read the lips of the guy inside. He goes, Jehovah's Witnesses. So we closed the door and didn't come to answer the door. So we went to the next house. We knocked on the door and shades of blinds went up. We read the lips of the guy. He goes, detectives. Oh. We're two little white guys coming to the door of this all black neighborhood. Closed the door. Third house didn't even have a doorbell. So we bang on the door. The blinds go up. Blinds go down. Guy comes to the door and opens it. It's one of the biggest African-American men I've ever seen. He takes a look at the two of us and he goes, hey, man, you zipper zipper. You come to put me on the Zippo Awards.
I was waiting for that because I was going to ask you about that being recognized and you were.
Yeah. By that guy. The other guys, I wasn't wearing a tie or a coat or anything, you know, so.
My story isn't anything like yours. But what I want to talk about is the humility of that and the humbleness of that, because when I left after just 4 or 5 years of doing sports in Channel 4 and 10 years overall in the media, but I had, you know, some people knew who I was as the weekend sports anchor. Nothing like yours. However, when I changed careers, and I'm now a rookie financial advisor, back then you cold called. We called it dialing for dollars. Mm. And I'd get my list of strangers, and I would make 200 to 300 dials a day.
Wow.
Just hoping to get a live person on the other end of the phone to see if they had any money, number one. That was important. And if they did, were they working with anyone? And then you'd try to develop a conversation. And it was just an act of desperation, but it worked. I mean, you worked really hard. But the reason I tell you that is one day I'm the weekend sports anchor and I'm hanging out and talking to Bob Gibson and people like that. And the next day I'm calling strangers and getting the phone hung up. And I remember one time in the first few months of doing that, a guy picks up the phone and I said, hi, this is Dave Simons at Prudential Securities. That's where I started. That doesn't exist anymore. They were gobbled up by other firms. And he goes, Prudential Security? I already got a security system. I said, no, Prudential Security. It's like stocks, securities. It's Prudential. Oh, yeah. What's your name? Dave Simons. He goes, the sports guy? And I said, well, I've changed careers and this is what I'm doing. And so I kind of went through my spiel. He goes, nah, I don't have any money. But while I got Sean, you think the Cardinals are going to sign Ozzie Smith? I don't know. I don't really follow it that much anymore, but you have a nice day. And I remember thinking, what did I do to myself? Why couldn't I have just been happy? Because one thing I didn't mention, I left on my own. I wasn't fired. I just got kind of burned out a little bit. And
sure.
Zip, you had mentioned at the time you didn't want to be a weekend guy, especially if you work for some iconic guy. You were the iconic guy. And so I thought, if I stay here, I'm not going to ever be the number one guy. And anyway, if Zip leaves, it's probably Doug Vaughn, who has already been there. And so I had an agent, and he told me about a job in Cleveland and a job in New Orleans. And I just thought, you know, at the time, I'm 31 years old. I just had my wife was pregnant with Taylor, who I can't believe is now close to 29 years old and just got married. It's amazing how quickly life goes. But I thought, I can go around the country and never be guaranteed after my initial contract that it'll be renewed. You know the feeling.
Yep.
And I've got a young family now. I'm back in my hometown. someday I'm going to be, excuse me, a 50-year-old bald guy. And by the way, I was right in both cases because I had hair back in my early 30s, but I knew my DNA. And someday that decision is going to be made for me that we don't need a 50-year-old bald guy on the news when we can hire this really good-looking 24-year-old for half the money. Right. So I'm going to make that decision for me now at age 30, 31. And it was the best thing I ever did. So that gets back to what were you thinking? I just told you that it just dawned on me, what did I had a good thing going, and now I'm cold calling, and people aren't giving me any money, and they want to know about Ozzie Smith. That had to have hit you at some point. You kind of addressed it. You were on top of the world. By the world's standards, you have everything. And now you're going into some of the worst parts of town who, by the way, need to hear from people like you at that time. And God love you for doing that. But did you wonder, God, why are you doing this? Look at where you had me, and now look where you have me.
Right. Well, the story progressed from there because we were doing that one day a week. We'd spend 2 hours ringing doorbells in these drug-ridden places and trying to get into people's homes to talk to them. But my partner at the time that I mentioned, Declan Duffy, asked me what I was doing at the time. So I said, I'm not doing much. You know, I'm still doing the Zippo Awards. I'm doing some radio commentary. He says, why don't you come and see where I work? It's okay. So he takes me downtown to 18th and Locust in the city of St. Louis to a building, a red brick, 7-story, 100-year-old building. And outside the sign says MERS, Metropolitan Employment and Rehabilitation Service. I said, this is where you work? He goes, yeah, come on in. I'll give you a tour. That's okay. So he says, let's start at the top. Take the elevator up to the 7th floor. It was a 7-story building. The 7th floor was a halfway house for women prisoners completing their prison terms, sleeping in the building at night, going out during the day looking for employment, so when their terms ran out, they would have a place to go and a way to make living. Wow. He says, go down to 6. So I went down to the 6th floor. The 6th floor was training for people who had suffered traumatic brain injuries in accidents, boating accidents, biking accidents, car accidents. Their brains would never function again as fully as they once did, so they were in training to adjust to a lesser career depending on whatever parts of their brain they had left. We go down another level to the 5th floor. It's the blind and the deaf, the vision impaired and the hearing impaired. And they're working with counselors trying to prep them for part-time or full-time jobs that they could do with their severe disabilities. We go to the 4th floor. It's a training ground for people learning the HVAC trade, learning how to fix furnaces and air conditioners and stuff, because at that time there were jobs in that era. We go on the 3rd floor. The 3rd floor was offices. We go on to the 2nd floor. It's a sheltered workshop for people who were so impaired they would never be able to work competitively. But there they were, 50 people strong, working, stuffing boxes, sealing envelopes, unpacking things, doing these menial little jobs with these big smiles on their faces. So many Down syndrome people in there, so many people with different disabilities. Happy working in the sheltered workshop. We go on to the 1st floor. It's the cafeteria. The cafeteria was used as a training ground for the restaurant industry. They were training people for jobs as cooks and waiters and waitresses and greeters and all kinds of stuff, dishwashers. So Declan says, well, that's the tour. What do you think? I said, well, he said, you know, you could really do it. You could be a big help around here. I said, Declan, this is like social work. This is the most amazing place I've ever seen, but I'm a trained broadcast journalist, and I want to do this. He said, oh, no. You could really. I said, how could I help? He says, your name would open doors with employers to help our people in training get jobs in the community. So I thought, well, can't deny that as a possibility. So again, it was like that moment when I saw that priest out at the Solitude. there was a pause, and all of a sudden I heard myself say, okay, let's give that a shot. At which point I was going, what are you doing? What are you doing here?
Does the Holy Spirit always have to take over at times?
I know, right?
Can it just be quiet sometimes?
I had no interest in doing this. I didn't know this place existed. And the following Monday, I'm interviewing, and they give me a job as a job developer. That was my position. So after making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in TV, they paid me $22,005 to be a full-time job developer and work with people with severe disabilities, mental and or physical, to help them get jobs in the community.
There was never, though, a woe is me for you, was
no,
there?
No. I was stunned when the radio show went off the air, because that was my dream to escape TV but still do broadcasting. When that went off the air, I was stunned. I didn't know what to do. I was probably numb. But then all of a sudden that phone call came and I started doing this work. So it was very, very strange, Dave, because now I had a day job. I never had a day job since ever. So I got out of college and went to TV. That was it. Now I had a day job where I was reporting to work for 8 in the morning and getting off at 4 in the afternoon. So I said, well, this is good. I could maybe find a girlfriend. I could have some friends. I could go to a movie or have dinner with people at night now. This is good. But the work was very strange because it was, I guess the word would be, humble or humbling, or probably both, because I would take a client, and a typical client would be someone with some kind of disability, and I'd be driving them to Schnucks and asking for a meeting with the manager to try to get him to give this kid or whatever an assessment to see if he could be a bagger, to see if he could bag groceries successfully and be employed there. And I would stand there and watch the conversation and guide it and this and that, ask the guy what he thought. Then I'd drive the young person back to the MERS and try to say, we might get this job, we might not. I'll see you tomorrow, all this stuff. And I thought, this is so different from what I've done my entire life.
And you know, when you're describing that, that is common today. Go into a Deerberg's or a Schnucks or a Walmart. And you're right, 30 years ago, these folks who had these disabilities weren't given much of a chance. And now it's common.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so you were kind of at the beginning stages of that in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. There were very few people employed at the places we'd take them to with disabilities like that.
You know, Zip, you touched on this, and this gets into something very personal for you. One thing that I've known about you from the beginning when I first met you in the late 80s, and you wrote about this in your book, in your autobiography, or your autobiography, which was terrific, by the way. What's the name of it?
For a Greater Purpose.
For a Greater Purpose. So, folks, if you haven't seen it, check it out. Amazon's still out there. It's just a great, great book of a man who humbly talks about his life and his walk and a lot deeper into some of the things we're talking about. But you've kind of addressed this, that one of your biggest regrets about your life when you seem, you know, you had it all, was your lack of a personal life. And you just knew in your heart, probably as a young man, you would get married, you'd have kids, and you would have this idyllic Leave It to Beaver life someday. And it didn't happen.
Right.
So tell me about when you look back, are you comfortable with that now and you accept it, or is there still a longing there?
Dave, there was always a longing to have a wife and a family and that intimacy and a relationship with someone and to have kids and do all those things. I mean, I grew up in a beautiful family. I had a couple of brothers and a mom and dad and playing Little League, as we discussed before. It was great. And I always thought that would be me when I grew up. And it never happened. And that is something I always felt I missed in life, and I sorely missed, because it's what I always wanted. And it's hard. Yeah. Now I'm 71 years old. Now I'm committing my life to the Lord and doing work for Him. And I have no desire now to get married or have kids, obviously, and whatever. So it's not a sore point now. I'm at peace. I'm filled with the joy and the love of the Lord. He's my best friend. He's my lover. He loves me more than all the women in the world put together anyway. And I'm very, very comfortable with that. I'm at great peace with that.
That's awesome to hear. And so tell everyone what you're doing today.
Well, I started an apostolate called Mater Media. Mater is the Latin word for mother, so it's dedicated to the Mother of God. And at first, it was 2012 when we started it. And the idea was to write, print, publish, and distribute books that would evangelize the Catholic faith or bring people closer to God. So I started out by writing a novel for teens called My Rock and Salvation that was set in St. Louis. And I'd never written a book before. I took a year just studying novel writers and how to write novels and reading books and everything else. And finally, I decided to write it. And we did a few edits and had a young guy working with me. He was an atheist, by the way, which was ironic, Eric the Atheist. And he was a long-haired kid just out of college, but he could type 120 words a minute without making a mistake.
Hired.
And he was right. So we published that book, and we got 20,000 young people reading that book. Right. So I said, okay. So then I wrote my autobiography, which you mentioned, For a Greater Purpose, the next year. And then people started coming to us with other book ideas, so we became a publisher of books. We've published 17 books now, fiction, nonfiction, memoirs, poetry, mostly first-time authors who wouldn't get the time of day from a major publisher, but have something valuable to say. And then from there, we went into other forms of media. Our original mission became to make Jesus Christ more known and more loved by more people through media. So we still publish the books and still are publishing books, working on two right now. But we went into movies to bring good, inspirational movies to the public. Started out with a 10-minute film by David Henry, who wrote and directed a film coming out of his Wizards of Waverly appearances with Selena Gomez. We promoted that, and then another movie he did, and then the movie Bella was out there, and then Unplanned, and met all kinds of Hollywood people. I never knew any of these people when I was in TV, and yet today I'm working with three or four different movie companies and good friends with a whole bunch of them and different things. And one of them is a movie that we're very excited about, Angel Studios, that does The Chosen, just bought the rights 3 weeks ago to a movie we've worked on for 3 years called Sound of Freedom. It's a movie about child sex trafficking. Tough, tough subject, but a subject that needs to be brought to light. And Jim Caviezel plays the real-life hero in there. Angel Studios bought it 3 weeks ago. They're crowdfunding it like they did The Chosen. In 3 weeks, they've raised $2 million already to get into theaters. It's going to happen later this year, which will be a big deal. So, it's
based on a true story, right?
Well, based on a true story, yeah. Yeah. So anyway, we work in the movie business, which is exciting. We work in concerts. We did concerts with young musicians out of Nashville who were trying to get their first EP out there. We'd sponsor concerts in people's homes, and 35 people would show up, but it would give them some experience. We work with a concert pianist named Eric Jenis, who goes into prisons with world-class musicians and brings the light of Christ into the darkest places in the country. He's played more than 1,000 prison concerts in the last 20 years. So we do that. And so we got music and books and movies, and we do some DVDs and online stuff too. And it's really a fulfilling life and a busy life.
You're in your early 70s. Where does Zip Rezepa see himself in his early 80s? Still doing this? God willing?
I think so, as long as it's God's will. I just pray for God's will to be done, to direct our ways and whatever projects, and they just keep coming, and we just respond. We just say, yes. Yes, Lord, yes, we can do that. You want us to do that? Yes, we'll do it. And I just think that's my calling for the rest of my life, as long as I'm fit and able to do it.
You are very vocal about your faith. The world doesn't always like that. How has it changed since the 90s when you first got out of TV and started doing this? Do you find people are more accepting, or has the world become more divided and like, oh, you're just one of those Christian nuts? What do you see in your personal experience?
Well, I think people appreciate what we're doing. People that are of the same mind that, want to keep God in our society, but so many people want to push God out of our society. And just in the last year or so, we've felt the brunt of it. Dave, I've been canceled on Facebook permanently. Our apostolate, Mater Media, has been canceled on Facebook permanently. We started a program called the Celebrate Catholic Marriage Experience, which people say, well, why can't you do it for everybody, not just Catholics? Well, the problem there is if you just say it's the marriage experience, you get all kinds of people in the redefined definition of marriage, of same-sex people and this and that. That's not our ministry. That's not what we consider marriage as Catholics. It's between a man and a woman. So we were running these YouTube ads to drive people to a webinar where we explain the program and get them around the country to be interested in us bringing this program to them to inspire couples in their marriage. YouTube refuses to run our ads because they're religious. We don't say anything about religious in them, but the term Catholic marriage makes them...
It's a deal killer for them.
Kicks them off. So we can't use YouTube. We're off Facebook. We're not doing anything wrong. We're not attacking anyone of any persuasion at all. We're not antagonizing anybody. We're not pushing on the Catholic definition or anything. We're just trying to reach people about our Catholic marriage and our celebration of it and encourage people in Catholic parishes because marriage is being attacked and they're suffering. And the pushback from the platforms is just disheartening, to say the least.
Your views on social media then, because whatever your viewpoints are to anyone listening or watching right now on gay marriage or traditional marriage or whatever, that's not what we're going to talk about or debate here necessarily. My point is there is so much darkness that is allowed through social media and so much vile content, but the people in charge who decide as the gatekeepers, what gets on and doesn't get on has to be very maddening and frustrating for you.
Well, it is. It's such a it's such a contrast of what's allowed and what isn't allowed. I mean, look at the music industry. I mean, in a way, the woke movement is good and it teaches respect of all people and you don't denigrate women or you don't take advantage of them or this or that. And yet, if you listen to the most popular rap songs, they're all about abusing women and about all the body parts and all kinds of things that people do all the time. And yet the culture supports that. You can do that all you want, because the culture says so. But if you go into an office or something and make a half off color remark or a sexist remark or somebody, you're fired, you're out, you're everything else. And I'm not saying you should be making those kind of remarks. So it's just such a strange thing where the culture is ruling. You know, we can talk about the forces of evil, but I think they're at work. It's just amazing how from politics to the workplace, to music, to entertainment, to speech, to relationships, to body parts, to the existence of the two genders is all ruled, it seems, by people who want to push an agenda one way. And if you're against that, then you're in danger of being canceled.
No wonder you and Bill O'Reilly are friends. You could, I mean, I'm making a joke, but seriously, I mean, obviously you two share very similar viewpoints on that. Do you guys talk about that?
Oh, yeah.
Probably all the time, right?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's end this on something much more lighthearted.
Okay.
I always like to ask people in your position who have been around, one of the things that I noticed when I was in sports is fans always want to know about their idols. Well, tell me about what's Albert Pujols really like? Of course, I wouldn't know that. It was well after, or people before our time. Was Stan the Man really as nice as he was? So, you know, back in my day, tell me about Ozzy. Tell me about Brett Hull. And I would say, well, I got stories I can tell you on the record and stories that I can never tell. So just in the St. Louis area, who was your favorite sports person that you love to deal with you can think of?
I love Brett Hull because, you know, when he was scoring like 80, 90 goals a year, everybody wanted to know about him. And he was the kind of guy that didn't really want to toe the corporate line.
No.
He would tell you what he really thought sometimes, which, as you know, when you're doing some post-game interviews or something, that is refreshing when they'll say what they really think. So I love Brett Hull for that. I loved Ozzie Smith with the Cardinals. I mean, I loved Ozzie. He was always a gentleman to me. He was very nice to me. He'd always talk to me. If I needed a live shot, he would do it. Of course, it was kind of reciprocal. You know, when Ozzie's contract ran out toward the end of his career and he was going around as a free agent and maybe I'll sign with Kansas City, I did a fist-pounding commentary on Channel 4 saying, if Anheuser-Busch doesn't, if the Cardinals don't sign Ozzie Smith, they should sell the ball club. And the next day I was on the carpet in Alan Cohen, the general manager's office.
I remember that.
Saying, Zip, do you know how much money Anheuser-Busch spends on our television station and advertising? I said, Alan, I don't. But if they don't re-sign Ozzie Smith, they should sell the ball club.
Oh, my God. And the Brett Hull thing, I don't know if you recall this, but I interviewed him, and Brett and I got to know each other very well, and I loved the guy as an interview because you never knew what he was going to say or what would come out of his mouth. But it was, man, I don't even remember what the subject matter was. Oh, I know what it was. Remember Adam Oates used to... He'd sign a contract, and 6 months later, he'd want to redo it. Yeah, and his agent would be like, oh, let's do it. And finally, the Blues said, look, this is the third time. We're not going to keep doing this. Well, Brett knew where his bread was buttered on the ice because he had Mr. Assist Maker, future Hall of Famer himself, dishing the puck to him all the time. And he wanted Adam there. And so he was very vocal, sign Adam Oates. So I happened to get Brett coming off the ice after practice. And these negotiations were very touchy. And the players knew, don't talk to the media about this. Brett, no. And so he was very honest and said, oh, the Blues were, they're blowing this. And I'm like, oh, this is good stuff. Remember Susie Matthew?
Oh, yeah.
Vice president of
public relations.
Public relations for the Blues. Long time. Very influential and powerful position. Well, she's up this is the old arena, hearing this interview. And she's like, Brett? And Brett kind of looked up and was like, yes, Mom, and walks away. And I'm like, doesn't matter. We've got it. Well, Susie stops and says, you can't run that. And I said, well, yeah, we can. Well, no, you can't. I said, but we can. So we go back. And by the time we got back to the station, only 10 minutes away, Alan Cohen is down in the newsroom and pulls me into the office with the news director. Says, Dave, tell me about what happened. I told the whole thing, and Alan said, I don't like when anyone demands that we don't run things. And that gets the hair up on my neck. That's what Alan Cohen, at that time the GM, said. Alan, I agree, but we're not going to run it. What? And he gave some convoluted answer why we can't be doing this and it's not worth it. But I wrote about it in my Blues book called Blue Fire, but that gets to your Brett Hull part and why I love hockey so much. These were terrific people to deal with. Yep. And Brett was such an iconic player. And I do want to end on one story while we're talking about it, because it is well known. Your little tiff with the white rat, Whitey Herzog, because of something you said on the air, and he vowed he would never talk to you again. And he stayed true to that for a long time. Tell us about that.
Yes, it was spring training 1985. The Cardinals had, they won the World Series in 82. 83 and 84 didn't go very well. Bruce Sutter, the closer, left and went to Atlanta. Things weren't looking so good for the Cardinals going into 85. So Bill Verdon came in as a special instructor in spring training. The Cardinals had hired Tal Smith as a consultant. So I did a story that Tal Smith, when he was with the Yankees and with the Astros, had hired Bill Verdon as the manager in New York and in Houston, and now Bill's hanging around as an instructor in spring training.
Uh-huh.
So I just suggested that if the Cardinals had a terrible year, he could be the guy waiting in the wings that the new boss, Tal Smith, might be bringing in. So in those days, you can only watch the stuff on TV. Whitey was down in Florida. His buddies in New Athens, where he grew up, told him when I ran that story on TV, that Zipper Zipper guy's trying to get you fired. So Whitey confronted me, says, you're trying to get me fired. I said, I am not. I'm just running a story, Whitey, that Bill Verdon's down here and Tal Smith is in here. I love you, Whitey, but So I says, nah, you're trying to get me fired. I will never speak to you again. And for 5 years,
he
never spoke to me.
The manager of the most iconic baseball team around, you're the sports director in that city, and the manager's not talking to you.
Right. Every spring, Bob Costas would go to Whitey and say, Zip's a good guy. Why don't you end this? He says, he's ready to apologize. I say, yeah, Whitey, I'm sorry. Next year, Jack Buck would go to him. He's an influence guy. Whitey, Zip's a good guy. You can let it go. Nope, I'm never talking to you. 5 years. And then in 1990, after 5 years, when Whitey had pretty much decided to leave, he left in June, I think, in the middle of a season.
Yes.
When the Cardinals were playing
yes.
poorly, and he was so frustrated that nobody would hit the opposite way, and the players were doing anything, and he couldn't take it. That season, early that year, he said, "Zip, I think you've paid your dues. I'll do an interview with me." So I said, "Good." So I went in, and he did a long, long interview. I'm sure I didn't at the time put two and two together. He was thinking of leaving.
Yeah.
He did such a long interview, made a 10-part series out of it,
wow.
talking about how he came and him and Gus eating, you know, beard sausage and how he got Suter and he got all these deals. He told me the whole thing of his career. And I thought, well, he's really making it up to me. This is incredible.
5 years worth of information for you.
So I ran that 10-part series, and then almost immediately afterwards, he resigned. So I think he knew he was playing me, knowing that I would recount the glory days in this 10-part series,
yeah.
and then he'd walk away. But I didn't mind. I mean, we were crushing it during Rating Book in May, and then he left in June.
And so, that was big news, man. Just out of the blue,
right,
he just ups and quits. Nobody,
yep.
not the white rat. And I remember that was the big story of, like, who's going to be the guy? I mean, Red
right.
took over in the interim, and then, of course, we got yep. Joe Torre. So,
anyway. Ever after, Whitey and I are okay. I see him sometimes, "Hey, Zip, how you doing? Good, Whitey, how you doing?" You know,
yeah.
So made up.
Whitey always loved the print guys. He
oh,
never
yeah.
always liked the TV
yeah,
guys.
Yeah, I think that was part of it too. Yeah.
yeah, yeah, but good guy. Well, Zip, you're a good guy. You've been a friend of mine now for 30 plus years. I appreciate the friendship. You helped me out so much in my days at Channel 4. Mm. And God love you. And I don't know if we got another 30 years left in us. combined, we do. We'll do that. But appreciate you spending time with us on the Simon Says podcast.
Dave, it's been an honor and a joy to be with you today.
All right. Take care.
Thank you so much for listening. And please forward the link to this podcast to friends, family, neighbors, even strangers. They'll thank you later. If you'd like more information on our wealth management team, just go to your search engine and type in Simons and Cordes. S-I-M-O-N-S and C-O-R-D-E-S, Simons and Cordes. And the website will be the first thing that pops up. I'll talk to you again soon on the next episode of the Simon Says podcast.